So today I wanted to get into Romans 11, and we'll read through it. Maybe I'll hold my kind of little commentary until after we read through the chapter. It's on page 133, Romans 9. I mean 11. Sorry. Yeah, this Romans 11.
Which verse?
One. And I think we're only going to get through the first 10 verses. Okay. I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah? How he pleads with God against Israel. Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have demolished your altars. And I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. What then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened, as it is written. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see, and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. And David says, let their feast become a snare and a trap, a pitfall and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see and bend their backs forever. So, I guess one of the things that has been running through my mind as I've been spending time looking over this chapter, but also the other chapters like Romans 9 and 10 as well, is this principle of humility, and that it just seems to me that it's much more important than we really appreciate in our day-to-day lives. And I guess part of it, you know, we can look at the very beginning of this section, and I think it kind of points us in this direction. Paul says, I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. So I don't know if you remember, at the beginning of Romans 9 and 10, he keeps going back, and these chapters are just arbitrary. We've given them numbers. I forget who was responsible for breaking them up into chapters and verses. And I don't know if themes had anything to do with where they began and started, or if it was number count or anything. I've never done any research on it. But at the beginning of each of the previous two chapters, he kind of goes back to the Jews and, you know, the fact that they are significant, they are important in the whole, like, history of God's revelation and God's activity and the things that he's done. How we've learned about him has been in large part through his interactions with the Hebrew people, and also through, you know, with a lot of the other people around as well. So he still is saying, look, I am showing you that God's plan includes way more than just the Hebrew people. But don't get it, you know, confused that he's totally forgotten about them, because he hasn't, right? And what's our first clue that that's true? Well, Paul himself, he's a Jew. So he hasn't, he's a follower of Jesus. He's accepted that Jesus is the Messiah. So clearly, God has not forgotten about the Jewish people, the Hebrews. But the other part, and I'll read this second section here. And he says, God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have demolished your altars. And I alone am left. And they seek my life. Right? Elijah is in a pretty bad situation here. What I want to do is just take a minute and go back to 1 Kings chapter 19. And we're going to start in verse 9. And I'm just going to read just to kind of give us a little bit of an idea of kind of what was happening in a little bit more detail. And I can't get extremely detailed because I don't recall all the events that kind of led up to this. But just to kind of give us a little color into the picture. It's entitled, Elijah Meets God at Mount Horeb. And there he came to a cave, Elijah, and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and slain your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. This is what Paul was just quoting from. And he said, go forth. God said, go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by. And a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? Right, the same question he asked when Elijah first came into the cave. What are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and slain your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Right? He's restating to God's question the exact same answer. And the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And him who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Okay. So, what do I see happening here? If we go back to Romans, he just quoted from this section. He says, God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have demolished your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And then he says, so too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. And it made me realize we don't see the whole picture. We think we see the whole picture. Maybe, you know, I'm struggling in a certain area of my life. Sometimes it's my work, or maybe with, you know, some family circumstance, or just feeling like I don't have wisdom about something. But what I'm reminded of is that we just cannot see the whole picture. Look, Elijah felt like there was nobody else who loved God. He didn't know where they were. He couldn't find them. Who else? I mean, think about it. And I'm not just talking about, and including the children, I'm not just talking about people who call themselves Christians. But who else has allowed you to get to know them well enough that you could say, this one truly loves God? They're not perfect, but they are a righteous person, a righteous man or woman, because they humble themselves when they've done wrong. They strive to be godly and righteous. They seek to be at peace with the people around them as best they can and as best they know how. Willing to grow spiritually, right? How many people do you know like this that after you've gotten a chance to know them, you could say, yeah, I think that this person is really a righteous man or a righteous woman, a godly. I'm not saying perfect, right? I'm not saying the person who never makes mistakes. I'm saying, now, you might be able to say, I might know one person. I might know two people. Maybe I know three people that I think might be in that category. But this is interesting. We honestly, we just don't see it. We don't have eyes to see all that God is doing. We cannot see the whole picture. And also, you know, for the brothers too, I think it's very easy sometimes for us to feel like very discouraged or isolated or feeling like, you know, who else is, you know, seeking to really love God, to obey all of his commandments. And I'm not just talking about somebody who seeks to enjoy the benefits of having a hope of heaven and a sense of the forgiveness of their sins, but of somebody who desires to deny themselves and to die to their fleshly lusts and worldly values. And now, and again, we ask the question, but we can't make the assumption that we've arrived to that place. I mean, we are earnest in our hope to be that, which is why we encourage one another, hopefully, you know, more and more, and we try to strengthen one another to that end. But this has given me something to think about. We really don't know. Even to what is inside your heart or your heart. Like, how do I know? Right? I may have an idea, or you may have an idea. You might look at something that I do, and you say, that can't be. How could that? That can't be right. But sometimes we don't see the whole picture. We can honestly start to judge the people around us so prematurely. Just like he was saying, look, there's nobody else in Israel, and I'm the only one left, and they're about to take my life. There's not going to be anybody left. Anyway, as I was reading this, I realized this is an opportunity for me to be humbled. We don't see the whole picture. Then he says, so too at the present time there is a remnant chosen by grace. This is in Paul's day. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. Remember we talked, and children, I don't know if you remember, and children, I don't mean to be disrespectful, not little children, but, you know, young ones. You know, we talked about that grace is like God's kindness, his favor. But it's not just like somebody who you walk by and they say, hey, Daniel, how you doing? Good to see you. That's not great. Grace is actually the person who can, you know, you're going to feel the consequence of their kindness. There's an activity, there's an action that's going to be, you're going to feel the result of their kindness. Okay? So let's just keep that in mind as we're considering what God's grace means. It is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. So all that we receive is because of God's kindness, God's mercy. And this is something that has continued from, you know, the previous chapters, right? So it depends not upon man's will or exertion, but upon God's mercy, right? On his kindness that will, what's the phrasing that you were using, Amiri, for work? Actionable, right? So God's kindness is actionable. It's just not a nicety, right? So it depends not on man's will or exertion, but upon God's mercy. And remember in John 1, he says, but to all who received him, who believed in his name, God gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, not of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So what was it? To whom does God show kindness? Actionable kindness. To all who receive him. To all who believe in his name. Again, think back to, I'm not just talking about, and I don't think the Bible is talking about somebody who just says, oh yeah, I believe in the concept of a God, of a creator. I believe that maybe even he had a son named Jesus Christ. I'm talking about somebody who says, I love him and I want to obey him. Not a perfect man, not a perfect woman, but one who loves God. So God, in extending his kindness, his grace, he is giving power to us. To who? He sees something in you that is ready. It's like when a tree is ready to eat, when a fruit is ready to eat, you know, you can't just pluck it off anytime you want and say, okay, now it's ready, right? You have to wait till it's ripened. Not every fruit is ripened, right? And not every fruit is good to eat. But we do know that there is something about a piece of fruit or something, you know, a vegetable or whatever, that we have a sign of readiness in that. God considers what's inside of us. And remember this, he says, this is, so if he considers the faith in us, he also considers other stuff in us, right? So he looks at the faithful, he says, you know what? I'm going to empower that one, the one who believes and receives. I'm going to empower you. But the reverse is true as well, as we saw in Pharaoh. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to go back and I'm going to read in Exodus chapter 1. Because in Romans 9, he says, for the scripture says to Pharaoh, I have raised you up for the very purpose of showing my power in you, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. And that wasn't a favorable promise. He was saying, look, I'm going to use you as an example. Why? There was already something in Pharaoh's heart, in the way that Pharaoh was thinking about God, about the world, about the people of God. You can turn there if you want. You don't have to. I'm just going to read it. I'm going to the first chapter in Exodus. I just want us to see that we do get a glimmer of light. We get a glimpse into the heart of people, right? So we can see that how God begins to make his judgments. Okay? Now there arose, I'm in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the sons of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war befalls us, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the sons of Israel. So they made the sons of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. and in all their work, they made them serve with rigor. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphra, and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. If it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. But they let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? And let the male children live. And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and are delivered before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt with them well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So this is the Pharaoh that God is saying, I have raised you up for the very purpose of showing my power in you, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. What is Pharaoh's heart like?
Scared.
He's scared. What is, and I'm glad that you saw that from the very beginning. What does that drive him? What does that fear drive him to do?
To kill.
Yeah. Anything else?
To disobey.
He creates hardship. He starts to create controls on the people of God. He says, look, this is going to get out of hand, guys. These people are going to start getting more and more powerful. Does he know for sure what's going to happen with the Hebrew people? How could he know for sure? But what we do know is this. We do know that he's afraid of what might possibly happen. This is Pharaoh's heart. And you know that in the heart of one who's filled with fear, I mean, that can become a very dangerous platform for Satan to work in. When your heart is filled with fear, oh, what's going to happen? That person might say something, or this person might do something. All of a sudden, you are paralyzed from doing what's right, and then you run the risk of starting to try to figure out ways of really putting like a chokehold on your life and the lives of people around you. Why? I'm afraid. Now, I'm not saying that we should not be disciplined, or that we should not be exercise our responsibilities as fathers and so on, in terms of how we raise our children. And some, there are many times where you have to have certain rules in place to kind of help, you know, just govern the small society that we live in our own homes. But fear, and this is, I think, really kind of speaking to my heart, can drive someone to all kinds of really twisted behaviors. Fear, and then all of a sudden, I mean, he's acting not just like he's afraid, right? Sometimes when I think of fear, that's like somebody's trying to avoid some bad consequences that are going to happen. But he's showing me, at least, that fear can become aggression. And fear can then become like a violent aggression. We see that all over the place. I mean, you watch the news for a little bit and you start seeing, you know, people who might otherwise describe themselves as compassionate and patient and understanding and open-minded are willing to take up sticks with nails in them and throw things at other people. Why? Because they're afraid. And the fear it twists our judgment. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was also thinking on the other side of that, that here, you know, in many ways, Satan acts like Baal.
Yeah.
Or like Pharaoh, in a sense, and I think it pertains to the comment about, you know, kissing Baal and bowing down to Baal, but in order to constrain the work of God's people generally, that there's an active and ongoing campaign to subjugate and enslave, and that takes the form both of, you know, what we see Pharaoh doing here, just outright and vicious attacks on God's people in order to contain the work of the kingdom, or it could also be deployed in the form of pleasures, which essentially have the same effect of placing people in bondage. People become slaves to desire either for pleasure or to avoid persecution,
right,
or judgment or shame or whatever the case may be. And so I was kind of looking at this from the other angle of, you know, that this is a common methodology that's used in our world by, you know, wicked rulers in order to thwart God's work. And of course, if we bow down to the Lord, then he, you know, as ultimately we see with the Israelites, delivers us through great adversity, even including bondage to things like vice and sin and pleasure, which, you know, as I said, can be more effective in enslaving people than, you know, punishment, persecution.
Right. So. And even the lusts of the flesh, a lot of times we give in to those, mm-hmm. whether it's because we want to make more money to get more things, or there's, you know, you're tempted by some indiscretion.
Right.
You know,
Pharaoh could have said, you know, instead of killing all the men, set up brothels.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere on the outskirts.
Right.
It would have effectively accomplished the same purpose, which is that the men would be distracted, so, you know, caught up in pursuing their pleasure.
Yeah.
That they would have been effectively
right.
gone.
And I think that there's also, there can even be an element of fear in that, because humanity, we fear depriving ourselves of pleasure. Wait a minute. You mean I'm not going to be able to, and you fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. Wait, for what? Really? Like, all of a sudden, that's a threat to our just our well-being, mm-hmm. to our quality of life. Mm-hmm. And we fear that. And that can send us into behaviors that are, when we try to take control, we try to find a solution for that, we try to exercise using our judgment, right?
Right.
And our will, and it won't turn out well. But if we start to say, wait a second, and this is, it's so much easier to say it than to do it, to say, you know, may God's will be done. But God, please, put me in the position, in the right posture to humble myself. And that's why I felt like this is really about humility. And I wanted to just look over a few scriptures about humility, mm-hmm. that I feel like are good for all of us, especially, you know, young boys, young men kind of developing. And a lot of times, you know, you guys are at the stage in life where you have a lot of energy and you're starting to see what you're capable of, both, you know, in your minds and physically. And it's very easy to have a high picture of yourself that makes it hard for you to humble yourself, to receive what God is trying to show you. Because sometimes you don't even have a break in the day without somebody saying, or you hearing it, having a thought in your mind about how great you are, how accomplished you are, how smart you are, or something like that, right? And these are not bad things, but sometimes they distract us from, how do you humble yourself when it feels so good to have your ego stroked? Why do I want to humble myself? Why do I want to deny myself the pleasure of feeling good about myself? But that's not what humbling yourself is about. It's not to deny myself pleasure. And I just want to go, let's take a look at a few passages here. I'm going to look, and you don't have to turn there. I'm going to just kind of maybe try to quickly go through them. I'm going to look at James chapter 4 first. And verse 6 and 10. It says,
where are we?
James chapter 4, verse 6 and also 10, page 194.
194. What's the verse again?
6.
Okay.
But he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Remember, Pharaoh was trying to protect something. He was afraid. He thought he deserved something. He deserved the power and the authority. And he wanted to protect that. He wasn't going to humble himself to whatever God's will is. So he did receive a promise, right? God shows mercy upon whom he will, and he hardens the heart of whomever he wills. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. In verse 10, humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. He will lift you up. Was Pharaoh willing to humble himself so that God would lift him up? Absolutely not. Not when he could do it by his own strength and authority. Why wait for God? Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. I'm going to look at 138 in Psalms 138. Verse 6. That's page 484. For though the Lord is high, he regards the lowly. But the haughty, the prideful, he knows from afar. Let me read that again. For though the Lord is high, haughty, he knows from afar. He's not going to come if I find in my own heart that I am full of pride. God is going to be far from me. I'm constantly having to remind myself. Why? Do I have all these reasons to feel great about myself? I don't. But the flesh tries to convince me that I do. So that I'm distracted by maybe delusions of grandeur, right? I'm distracted by these things so that I will not humble myself. God regards the lowly. Do not be afraid of humbling yourself. Don't think, man, I'm going to miss out. And you know what? Then my life's going to be miserable. Don't be afraid of that. Why? Because if you humble yourself, God will exalt you. Do we know what that even feels like? To reject it? Humble ourselves, and he will exalt you. What will that feel like? And again, I'm asking the question, especially of the young people, because I think that's something to give some thought to. Because you may not have experienced what it feels like to be exalted by God. You might not even know what that means. But he is far from the haughty, the prideful. I'm going to look at Proverbs chapter 3. Verse 34. Toward the scorners, he or God is scornful, but to the humble, he shows favor. Again, this was not the way of Pharaoh. I'm going to jump over to Proverbs 29, 23. Why am I going through all these passages? I want to underscore the fact that this is not a small thing, and I'm really only scratching. I'm not even scratching the surface. Humbling ourselves is is it's one of those things that when you don't want to be humble, you think that's the worst possible idea in the world. I would never do that. Why would I possibly do that? What are you trying to take away from me? My freedom to just do what I want? But it's a misunderstanding. Proverbs 29, verse 23. A man's pride will bring him low, but he who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor. The same principle there from James. Five. Okay, great, perfect. Okay. Same principle there. A man's pride will bring him low. Did Pharaoh's pride bring him low? Do we remember what ended up happening to Pharaoh and the Egyptians? He had this whole master plan to eliminate the male children. What ends up happening? The firstborn of the Egyptians die, including his own son. And all his soldiers that he sends after the Hebrew people, they all perish. And then the Egyptians suffer through all these terrible ailments, the plagues. Just one thing after another. Why? Part of his condition, he could not humble himself. He couldn't even see ahead, right? He couldn't see ahead of himself to know what trouble he was going to get himself into. And the fact that this was going to affect a lot of other people. Matthew 23, verse 12. We read, "He who is greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted." This is right from Jesus' own lips. Is it important to humble ourselves? I mean, this is not now, it's not just an abstract principle. It's not just this idea now. We're saying Jesus, all his commands were about real life. What are we going to do today? Luke 22. This is the last one from the Gospels. Verse 26. Jesus again says, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For which is the greater, one who sits at table or one who serves?" So which is greater? The one who sits at the table and is being served, or the one who's serving? How would you answer that? You might know the right answer, but like in just daily, who would have a little bit more of the esteem? The person sitting at the table, or the person serving?
The one sitting at the table.
Right. Where should we be in relation to Jesus? Should we be the one sitting back at the table and just letting him serve us? Or should we be serving him as though he's at the table? Serving him. Listen to what Jesus says. "For which is greater, one who sits at table or one who serves? Is it not the one who sits at table? But I am among you as one who serves." What role did Jesus take?
Servant.
He was a servant. He humbled himself. If Jesus, our Messiah, our King, is willing to humble himself, why not me? Why not you? I just want us to remember this, and I'll finish with this. In Romans 11, verse 7, it says, "What then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened. As it is written, and I read this from before, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. And David says, let their feast become a snare and a trap, a pitfall and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see, and their backs, and bend their backs forever. Remember, in the last couple of weeks, we talked about how God will give one over to their sin. If you're so connected to your sin and you're committed to it, God will give you over to that. And sometimes you might not notice. You might say, hey, this is harmless. I'm enjoying this. It's not a big deal. Who are you to say I shouldn't do it? But sometimes the outcome is much, brings us much further down the road of sin and its consequences than we could foresee today. Just like Pharaoh, he could not anticipate that his lack of humility was going to lead him and many, many other people down this path. But we can't see it either. We don't know what comes after today. What do? We have to encourage one another. And also, the fathers, let's continue to encourage our children. But let's encourage one another not to give up the fight, to humble ourselves. And let's watch within ourselves if we suffer from a spirit of pride. I want to encourage you, all of us, to do what we can throughout each of the moments throughout the day to just see, is there a way for us to humble ourselves when in a conversation, in a communication, or just when we're walking around by ourselves? How can I humble myself in this moment? That's it.